Wollen wir, dass die alle gekommen sind? Unser heutiger Gast ist Professor Sami Schaffer. Er ist Technikhistoriker und kommt ursprünglich aus Southampton in Großbritannien. Studiert hat er am Trinity College in Cambridge und auch in Harvard. Und hat schon am Imperial College in London und an der UCLA unterrichtet. Zurzeit arbeitet er am Department of History and Philosophy of Science an der Cambridge University. Seine Arbeitsschwerpunkte liegen im Themenbereich History of Physical Science and Social History of Science und er ist Herausgeber des British Journal for the History of Science. Mr. Schaffer war auch schon in einer Dokumentation zu sehen, und zwar eine Dokumentation über die Geschichte des Lichts und seine Bedeutung für die Menschen. Er präsentierte und moderierte die BBC-Serie Light Fantastic, die 2004 ausgestrahlt wurde und die man sich auch gerne im Internet angucken kann, die ist sehr interessant. Zu seinen Veröffentlichungen, sein wohl berühmtestes Werk ist das, was er mit Stephen Shapley zusammengeschrieben hat, Leviathan and the Airpod, Hobbes, Boyle and the Experimental Life. Für dieses Buch gewann er 2005 den Erasmus-Preis. Und das Buch behandelt die Polemik zwischen Robert Boyle und Thomas Hobbes und der britischen experimentellen Wissenschaft. Mr. Schaffer hat bisher insgesamt 120 Artikel und Bücher veröffentlicht. Die wichtigsten davon sind The Uses of Experiment, Studies in the Natural Science, das 1989 rausgekommen ist. William Yule, A Composite Portrait, das 1991 rausgekommen ist, und The Science of Enlightened Europe, das 1999 rausgekommen ist. Und zu seinen neuesten Werken zählt The Mindful Hand, Inquiring an Invention from the Late Renaissance to Early Industrialization von 2007 und The Broken World, Go-Betweens and Global Intelligence von 2009.
Ja, und Professor Simon Schaffer war schon letztes Jahr in Darmstadt. Damals hat er einen Vortrag gehalten mit dem Titel Indiscipline and Interdisciplines, Some Exotic Genealogies of Modern Knowledge. Und ich bin mir sicher, dass diejenigen, die damals anwesend gewesen sind, sich daran gut erinnern. Und diesmal wird er uns etwas über Fact and Fiction in Enlightenment Epistemology sagen. Und bevor ich dem Sam Schaffer das Wort übergebe, will ich noch erwähnen, dass er sich nach dem Vortrag im Zoo-Café bei der Stadtkirche trifft. Wer das will, dann kann dorthin anschließen, nach dem Vortrag dorthin gehen. We are happy to present Professor Sam Schaffer.
Hello. It's very nice to be back here after less than 12 months, and even more amazingly, to recognize in the audience some people who heard me speak last April. I didn't think anybody who heard me speak last April would be back here this evening. It's an enormous honor to speak in the penultimate talk in this Ringvorlesung, and I've tried, I hope successfully, to address some of the issues that have brought us together. I begin by apologizing that because of my obvious weakness in the mother tongue, I have to speak in English, so I'm very sorry about that, and I hope that nevertheless what I say will be of interest and can be followed, but not too closely. So I start with a citation from David Hume, which I've used elsewhere. It may be a subject worthy of consideration, of curiosity, to inquire what is the nature of that evidence which assures us of any matter of fact beyond the testimony of our senses or the records of our memory. This part of philosophy, it's observable, has been little cultivated. We're in 1748. It may even prove useful by exciting curiosity and destroying that implicit faith and security, which is the bane of all reasoning and true inquiry, free inquiry. As Hume reminds us, the concept of facts, of matters of facts, plays a decisive role in Enlightenment epistemologies, and it did so back then, at the time, notoriously, as in the extremely troubling case of David Hume's distinction between relations of ideas and matters of fact. Matters of fact being the stuff of natural philosophy, principally grounded in habit and in custom. And it's done so, of course, for subsequent analysts, for whom projects in natural philosophy and natural history that established plausible and credible matters of fact have been taken to be the foundational aspects of an enlightened philosophy. In particular, enlightened philosophy has been typified in often satirical, amusing, witty, subversive, and critical reflection on the very basis of evidence. The puzzle, as Hume indicates, is the assault on implicit security in the name of the evidence of matters of fact. Here's my favourite satirical reflection by my favourite enlightened satirist, Voltaire. I know that there's almost but not quite nothing more annoying than people reading out what you can read for yourself in a PowerPoint presentation. So I'm not going to do it. So you're going to have to double task, okay? You have to listen to me. You don't have to listen to me. You can choose to listen to me while you read Voltaire, which is quite a challenge for me. So as you see in this text from the Philosophical Dictionary, Voltaire both points to and distracts attention from the institutional grounds of evidence. A miracle, in order to be a fact, must be performed in certain institutionally massive ways, with the Academy of Science present, with a company of guards in case the people disturb the miracle. So he points to an event in which Voltaire does not believe, remember, in order to point simultaneously to the extraordinarily high set of criteria on which any fact now depends. It's exactly that fascinating set of ambiguities that provide the burden of my talk. And in particular, what I want to suggest is that for the High Enlightenment, facts were the most stable of entities, but, and therefore, there was intense attention to the way the stability was achieved, and even more attention to undermining what seemed like the stablest, the most accomplished facts, such as miracles. In what follows, I therefore want to ask about the ways in which fait accompli were made, undermined, abridged, changed, and distributed. Footnote. There is no English translation, despite what every previous lecturer who's Anglophone has told you, for the title of this ring for laison. This is not a concept that exists in English, even though it exists in Britain. The earliest use of any term for vollendete Tatsachen in Great Britain is in 1847, and the term that's used is fait accompli. And it's a sign of British disturbance if a French object has to be imported. Secondly, the term fait accompli is always already, in English, political. Its first use in English is in a political context. The Spanish will not accept the British ownership of Gibraltar as a fait accompli. That's the first use of the term, vollendete Tatsache, in English. Right? And one could, I probably should have done, give a whole lecture on that complex thought. So it's a political, non-negotiable, but contestable fact. So in that sense, my argument is already made for me. We can talk about that afterwards if I leave myself enough time. The accomplishment of facts, fait accompli, neatly draws attention both to the work of fact-making, facts are accomplished through labor, and yet away from that work. Accomplished facts are effortless, anonymous, non-negotiable, they have no provenance. My conjecture is that in the period I'm concerned with, which is, roughly speaking, the summer of 1784, plus or minus 10 years, as you'll see, in that period, there was a profound relation between the denunciation, the critique, the subversion of established facts, and the construction of a new social body. This new social body was made up of the deluded, the ignorant, the foreign, the alien, and the primitive, who somehow lacked the accomplishments required of a world of facts. This is, therefore, not a story about what is the case, it's a story about what is plausible. In other words, what gets applause, literally, what you clap. I'm now going to give you a few very brief examples of the kinds of facts I'm trying to think about. This is one. In the late 1780s, and for four centuries before that, it was common in France and other European countries, but especially in France, to believe that if one was bitten by an enraged dog, one therefore had an unreasoning terror of water. Now, we now call that hydrophobia, and we think that's true. But the enlightened reasonably thought this was a primitive superstition. And the quote you have here is from a member of the Société Royale de Médecine, writing in the summer of 1784, that the belief that one is terrified of water after being bitten by a rabid dog is a primitive superstition and a sign of a cowardly imagination which can be cured by sound judgment and strong minds. That's exactly the sort of fact that I'm interested in. Ironic, because by our standards, the Enlightenment is here denouncing truth as superstition. Here's another very, very famous example. Right through the 16th, 17th, and 18th century, European journals and magazines and broadsides are full of stories that there are stones that fall from the sky. Now, we now know they do. But the enlightened, to a man, and they're massively male, thought this was a primitive superstition. The Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, the Journal des Savants, and comparable journals persistently denounce as primitive folk tales, the idea that there are stones that fall from the sky. And exactly as Voltaire would have expected, it is only more or less literally, when some stones fall from the sky on the head of a member of the Royal Academy of Sciences, that stones falling from the sky become aeroliths, meteorites. And as you see here, Chladni, in close collaboration with Georg Lichtenberg, whom I have to mention, otherwise I don't get dinner, published this kind of pamphlet, this from Kladni in 1794, published in Riga. But until then, the view was, this is the president of the Royal Society writing in 1759, that the idea that there are stones that fall from the sky is incredible, because if they did, there'd be much better evidence than we currently have. Understand, the only evidence we have comes from peasants. Comes from peasants. So it's not evidence in that sense. So this is a generalizable principle. It's not a very surprising one. There is a social valence to testimony. Plausibility follows, not precisely, but very closely, social contours. And the best established facts, in one sense, are those most likely to be rejected by the enlightened. The great theoretician, possibly the greatest theoretician of this problematic, is of course Pierre-Simon de Laplace, whose philosophical essay on probabilities of 1810 needs, as Lorraine Daston has taught us, to be read as an intervention in precisely this debate. Laplace was a veteran of a scandalous case, from his point of view, of this unstable notion of the plausible and the factual. Back in the 1770s, when he was a young academician, Laplace had taken part in a major debate at the Académie Royale des Sciences about whether comets can crash into the Earth. The announcement of this debate on the door of the Academy was enough to produce riots in Paris, an archiepiscopal mass at Notre Dame, stillbirths in Normandy, and the arrest of one of the academicians, Laplace's good friend Jérôme Lefrançais de Lalande. Laplace then ran a commission, his first, to correct public belief about probability, which only stimulated further riots by announcing that according to classical mechanics, the chances of a comet crashing into the Earth are 1 over 45,000, which seemed to most Parisians really quite a large number. These kinds of considerations prompt the calculus of judgment and the calculus of probability that Daston, Hacking, Marie-Noëlle Bourget, and other historians have analysed so well. The coincidence, I will read this out because it's really important, the coincidence of several remarkable events with the predictions of astrologers, diviners, and prophets with dreams has given birth to a host of prejudices that are still very widely distributed. So, end of part one. There is an extremely close relationship in the period of interest, the late Enlightenment, the period just before the fall of the Bastille, between what we could call, what I would call, a social history of plausibility and a notion of political and social critique and judgment. I'm impressed in particular, I'm not convinced, right? Impressed is English for you're wrong, but you're really, really good at your job. Okay? So I'm impressed by the argument of the great French social historian Jacques Revel, who has also written on this issue. In dialogue with one of his masters, Lucien Febvre, Jacques Revel has pointed out a significant change in the meaning of accusations of superstition or vulgar error in my period. Superstition switched from being threatening nonconformity to being inferior and uniquely mistaken viewpoints. The wardens of such beliefs, notably the scholastics and clergy, would be damned by the enlightened savant as no better than their flock. Scholasticism comes in the Enlightenment to be conflated with vulgarity. Revel writes, as you see, that there is a move between denunciation in the name of reason and denunciation in the name of social inferiority. And in his genealogy of the intellectual, Revel gives examples ranging from the ones that I've talked about, cometary scares, meteorites, to more familiar examples like diabolical possession and cometary movement. That's not where I want to go with this, though. I want to go with this story into two areas where we see the work of fact-making and denunciation being technically applied to judgments of fact themselves. My worry about Revel's argument, though I accept the premise, is the conclusion. The conclusion that he and other scholars like him have reached is that the job of fact-making, get it right, the job of fact-making from then on is completely separated from the job of social judgment and exclusion. That's not true historically. Here are two examples, one of which I'll rush through fairly fast, and then the other one I'll dwell on with almost obscene concentration. So this is the fast example. Perpetual motion, automata, and other self-moving devices. The project of perpetual motion, I'm showing you my favorite German perpetually moving wheel, which was erected at Kassel in the 1720s, and was obviously a fraud because it's kind of like stopped, right? And the man who designed it is a Saxon clockmaker called Johann Bessler, whom you probably know, who traveled and worked under the rather more elegant name of Orfirius, working for the Landgrave of Kassel, of Hesse-Kassel. I won't go into details, but the project of perpetual motion is normally pushed back to the very edge of traditional history of science. The enlightened tended, Laplace's friends, tended to hold that such projects could only be corrected or directed by the command of their abstract rational principles. It was in the 1770s and 80s, it was in fact in 1775, to be precise, that on the suggestion of the great mathematician and natural philosopher Jean d'Alembert, the Paris Academy of Sciences at last banned debates about perpetual motion. That's a sea change. They moved from energetic refutation and denunciation to silence. Perpetual motion was no longer within the true, as Michel Foucault would put it. 3 years later, in 1778, the French historian of mathematics, Jean Montucla, charted in detail a range of absurd schemes for perpetual motion and put them into his mathematical recreations. So perpetual motion shifted from being a dangerous enemy to a matter of silence to a matter of history within the course of less than 10 years. In the long fights about the viability of perpetual motion, one point emerges in the late 18th century with surprising clarity. There is no technical proof of perpetual motion's impossibility. Montucla and d'Alembert are absolutely clear about that, even though they formulate with extraordinary conciseness and efficacy various principles of conservation. They know that they do not have a universally valid, what we might call a universally projectable technique for showing that no perpetual motion device of the first or the second kind is possible. They don't have that. They know they don't have that. It is not in the name of physical technical impossibility that the ban and the historicization of perpetual motion is mainly carried out. The ban is mainly carried out, as we see in Montucla and D'Alembert, for social reasons. We must not encourage projectors to bankrupt their families, says Montucla in his speech in front of the Academy of Sciences. The thing has become implausible and therefore a social problem. And I think that is a very good example of the sort of issue on which we need to reflect. And now, an even more familiar example, which is the chess-playing Turk, who appeared in Germany, at least, in, again, the summer of 1784. I hope you're beginning to sense that the summer of 1784 is like pretty significant for the social construction of the implausible. In the summer of 1784, this thing appeared at the great fair in Leipzig, and then elsewhere in the German lands. Spectators, as many of you will know, were shown into a darkened chamber in which stood this large cabinet running on casters, wheels, and behind it an impressive full-scale model of a seated Turk smoking a pipe. And on top of the cabinet, as you see, was screwed a chessboard, the objects of the Turk's fixed attention. The showman, the animateur, would open the front and back of the cabinet, revealing gears and barrels and pulleys, and then shine a candle into the cabinet to show that nothing could be hidden there. And the cabinet is on wheels, so it's not connected directly to the stage. You see at one and the same time, ladies and gentlemen, the naked automaton, with his garments tucked up, the drawer and all the doors of the cupboard open. Unquote. After the automaton had been wound up extremely noisily, giving it enough power to run for about a dozen moves, the games would begin, the Turk moving pieces with his left hand, nodding his head when giving check, tapping the table and replacing any piece if a false move were made by his opponent. Quote, and I'm quoting from Windisch's pamphlet here, never before did any merely mechanical figure unite the power of moving itself in different directions as circumstances unforeseen and depending on the will of any person present might require. News of the automaton spread throughout the German lands during 1784. One report, sent by Carl Friedrich Hindenburg to the eminent head of the Berlin Observatory, Johann Bernoulli, reckoned that since the Turk must need both a directing and a motive force to play, it had to depend on a combination of mechanical gears and an array of magnets. An even more enthusiastic analysis, under the name of Johann Jakob Ebert, mathematics professor at Wittenberg, was published in Berlin in early 1785. Both texts were entirely convinced that the automaton had no human agency, much more convinced by that than they were worried by how the human on which it relied was concealed. Another observer, Johann Lorenz Berkmann, who saw the automaton during its visit here and then in Karlsruhe, accepted Hindenburg's idea that some form of magnetism must be involved, but urged instead that magnetic counters might be used to communicate to a hidden chess player inside. He published this hypothetical clarification of the famous chess player in his local Magazin für Aufklärung in early 1785. Now, I don't have time to go into this, but I see an extremely close link between the news and debate about the mechanical basis of the Turkish chess player and the appearance of Was ist Aufklärung in September of 1784 in Berlin on the next page of the newspaper to the story about the Turk. There seems to me to be an interesting theme, I'm sure it's been worked on in great detail, between the trope of automatism and reason in the Kant of the mid-1780s, both in Was ist Aufklärung and also, as here, in the third critique, in the Critique of Judgment, and this extraordinary publicity about whether a machine can be rational. And in particular, the very widespread view by the late 1780s that what we are dealing with, as Walter Benjamin would point out long, long after, is a human pretending to be a machine, pretending to be a human. In other words, what happens in the Turkish story, a great deal happens in the Turkish story, including the invention of the metronome by Johann Melzel, the composition of Beethoven's absolutely ghastly battle symphony, and eventually the Denunciation, which appears in London in 1821 over the name of a Cambridge-trained engineer and musician, Robert Willis. Like, that's the solution, folks. What happens in the Turkish story is not mainly increasingly ingenious conjectures about exactly how a machine could play chess. That is not the main narrative. The main narrative from the summer of 84 through to its denunciation in 1821 is, why is anyone deceived by this machine? That's the narrative of the Turk. It shifts ineluctably away from what we could call an industrial technical discourse of ingenuity towards a socio-ethical discourse of deceit, illusion, and histrionics. The main passage in An Attempt to Analyze the Automaton Chess Player of Mr. de Kempelen is a reflection on the deluded quality of the masses, not a reflection on the ingenuity with which the chess player is concealed inside the machine. This is a slow displacement, but a real one, and it captures perfectly, I'm arguing, the direction in which the model of accomplished facts moves in the period that concerns us. So that's the end of part two. What I've tried to do so far then is to indicate the dialectical two-facedness of fait accompli in this period, that one persistently in the 1780s and after draws attention to the provenance and construction of facts, partly in order to denounce them, partly in order to reinforce the authority of those who claim a monopoly over the role of judging and making them. And this in turn produces an ever more fully characterized social map of those who either at the moment cannot or never will be able to distinguish between fact and fiction, reality and illusion, truth and superstition. For the final part of my talk, I want to extend that analysis to the global politics of this moment, because the High Enlightenment is also the period of what British historians have learnt to call the Imperial Meridian. The period of the Second British Empire, for example, the period of worldwide imperial crisis, of primitive accumulation, of massive economic transformation, of global trade, and the establishment of racist and exploitative and unequal balances of power. Those processes both facilitate and, in ways we could discuss afterwards, I hope, enable the kinds of hierarchies about what is fact and what is fiction that I've been reflecting upon with you up till now. So for my final case, again, it's prompted by a German pamphlet, this one of 1792. My final case is the Giftbaum, the poison tree of the East Indies, because this story has features that I think open up our discussion of fait accompli in very interesting and pathological ways. This is a pamphlet made by the Erlangen pharmacist, apothecary, naturalist and botanist, founder of the Botanical Society at Regensburg, Ernst Wilhelm Martius. His picture is to the left. And it collects together a vast number of stories about a tree that grows in the East Indies, perhaps in Macassar, as the name implies, perhaps in Amboina, the Dutch headquarters of the spice trade, perhaps on the island of Java. And the main thing about this poison tree, this Giftbaum, is that it kills everything for a radius of 15 miles or more. There's a lot of other things you're about to learn about this tree. But that's the main thing you need to know. Don't go there. So this is a leaf and branch from the tree. This is an image made in London in 1817 by an American botanist called Thomas Horsfield, who worked for the East India Company in London and in Java. And you can begin, I hope, fairly quickly to see that the existence of this image is a refutation of the story. Right? I mean, think about it. So this is the geography of the poison tree. It's the geography of European obsession with spice. Cloves, nutmeg, pepper. The other things I'm looking forward to this evening. As many of you will know, from the late 1500s onwards, Europeans with armed vessels arrived in the East Indies principally to extract these herbal commodities. Notably, in the area that I'm interested in, let's go back to the map, between Macassar in southern Sulawesi, Celebes, and Amboina, which is where almost all the cloves in the world came from, and Banda, which is where almost all the nutmeg in the world came from. Well, the reason why almost all the cloves on the left and nutmeg on the right came from there is because of a very specific British and Dutch economic policy, which has a very simple name, exterminism. From the 1620s onwards, Dutch and English traders killed all clove and nutmeg trees that were not growing in coastal plantations under their direct military control. They killed as well almost all growers on Ambon and Banda who were not working in those plantations. As the great German-Dutch naturalist, about whom we're about to hear more, Georg Rumpfius, explains in his posthumous Natural History of Ambon, the Dutch make war on trees, not men. So exterminist monopolism is the policy of the European spice trade in the East Indies. And I'm showing you here a romanticized Dutch image of made in fact the 1720s, of the end of the Macassar War in 1678, when the Dutch established complete military control over clove and nutmeg production throughout the East Indies. The only but the major resistance to them is in the inset. And now I hope you can start to see, as we say in English, why the poison story has legs. The principal resistance to British and Dutch exterminist monopolism is poison. The Macassar troops, who were employed by the Sultan of Makassar, it was an Islamic principality from the 1580s onwards, used poisoned darts against their Dutch and English enemies. And these darts were poisoned with a range of exquisitely differentiated forms of vegetable poison, for which they used only one name, upas, which is the Malay word for vegetable poison. And upas is the name that Rumphius gives to the toxic tree that destroys everything for miles around. Death has pitched his tent near this tree. Everything perishes that its wind touches. Historical anthropologists who've worked on this story, and I'm relying on them, this is not even secondary, this is tertiary research, argue, I think compellingly, that the origin of the upas story, the origin of the poison tree story, has to be understood as a projection by the Europeans onto East Indian nature and culture. The poison tree perfectly figures Dutch monopolist exterminism. It is a tree that kills everything except itself for miles around. It grows only in the most distant mountainous regions, which are precisely the regions the Dutch and British never controlled. The elements of the story, including, which Rumphius adds, that the tree is always surrounded by a golden serpent coiled at its base with a stone in its forehead, which is a snake stone that cures the tree's poison. I mean, pointlessly, as one might think. All of those elements, as ethno-historians have pointed out, are made up of common European elements. This is a European colonial story that is then increasingly projected onto Oriental nature. End of part three. Part four. Joseph Banks. Joseph Banks is the reinventor of British imperial botany, of natural resource imperialism in the late 18th century. After his journeys unpromisingly to Iceland and much more promisingly, both from a botanical and a sexual point of view, to Tahiti with Captain Cook in 1769, he made his London headquarters one of the world centres of the distribution of natural resource, imperially significant commodities worldwide. This is David Mackay's map of Banks's global networks. Each blob is either a garden or a collector or a source or a plantation which provided plant samples for Banks in London at Soho Square and at Kew Gardens. This is headquarters with Banks, his house in the background with the rather glamorous windows, now the headquarters of the London Zoological Society, and his lieutenants, William Marsden, who's his chief expert on Oriental philology, for example, the first adequate dictionary in Malay and English, and James Lind, who's his chief medical representative on Earth, the man who began to suppose that you could cure scurvy with lemons and limes. They band together to sponsor a German-Dutch surgeon called Johann Nikolaus Fuchs, who arrives in London in the summer of 1784. And they arrange the translation of this version of the story of upas, the poison tree of Java. This is the longest, the most detailed, the most circumstantial version of this story. It has enormous circulation, vast authority. It becomes a fact. We can discuss afterwards whether this qualifies as a fact. This destructive tree is called in the Malayan language Bohon Upas and has been described by naturalists, says Fersh's story. He means by Rumpfius. He then goes on to talk about the way in which this story is so marvelous and so miraculous that you, the readers of the London Magazine, are very unlikely to believe it. And then he provides more and more evidence that it's credible and indeed true. These are two Parisian images of the ceremony of collection of poison from the tree. What Fersh says is that in Makassar and Java, criminals condemned to death are given the chance of going to collect some poison from the upas tree. A chance they take because, roughly on Pascal's wager grounds, if the choice is we will remove your head or travel 25 miles in that direction to a completely lethal tree, get the poison and come back, you will get the poison and come back, or at least you'll try. So this is the grieving Islamic family sending the condemned criminal away, and here he is at the tree. And you can see the effects of the tree on previous condemned criminals. The mask is, as they say in English, to die for. As I've emphasized, this is a fact with enormous circulation. It becomes a strophe in Erasmus Darwin's very widely read Loves of the Plants in 1792. In fact, Darwin reprinted the whole of Fersh's story as an appendix to Loves of the Plants. And it was there read by Byron and Pushkin and many others, and the upas tree becomes a social and cultural fact. At exactly the same time, and here's my point, the Fersh's story and Rumpfius's story begin systematically to be denounced by the enlightened, by the savant. First of all, predictably, by Carl Peter Thunberg, Linnaeus's successor at Uppsala, who'd visited Java to and from his great botanical journey to Japan in 1783. He then visited Joseph Banks and met Fersh and was deeply underwhelmed. And in a doctoral speech in Uppsala in 1788, he says this, and this is the crux of my story. See what's happening here. The belief in the story is transferred systematically from the Europeans to the Javanese. It is not the Europeans, Thunberg is telling us, who invented this story. It is not the Europeans who believe it. It is, and I quote, some artful Mohammedan priests who believe, absurdly, that no tree, shrub or grass will grow within 10 or 12 miles of it. It's exactly that transfer to undermine a fait accompli that interests me the most. And it's performed again and again. It's performed the following year in Martius's remarks on the Macassar Giftbaum, on the Macassar poison tree, in which Martius in Erlangen says unambiguously, no European believes this story. It's very widespread in Java because of their ignorance and superstition. The war against the superstition gathers ground during the course of the imperial meridian. It gathers ground massively in Napoleonic Paris, where a succession of imperial naturalists, savants, botanists, and geographers analyze the poison of various versions of this tree and then attribute the belief in the poison tree to the Javanese and the East Indians. You see here the Napoleon's greatest geographer, Conrad Malte-Brun, who publishes a book about the poison tree in 1807. The extremely significantly named French naturalist Latour, who was the naturalist on board the Baudin expedition. And notably Buffon's editor Charles Sonnini in 1810. Similarly in London, where the campaign against the poison tree is launched with ferocity, notably when the British take over Java during the Napoleonic War in 1811. Here is Thomas Horsfield, whose sample drawing of the tree we saw nearer the start of the show, and his boss, the appalling Thomas Stamford Raffles, who, about whom I could say a lot, but I won't. He was the founder of the London Zoo. I mean, he did some good things. He was the founder of Singapore. He was a great naturalist. That's it. He was riveted by the poison tree. He collected 250 different samples of upas and shipped them back to Kew Gardens in the capable hands of Thomas Horsfield. And they jointly composed this report. And here's exactly the dédoublement which I've been focusing on. It is in no small degree surprising that so palpable a falsehood should have remained so long without refutation. That's one late Enlightenment thought. It's obviously a fiction. It's amazing that anybody ever believed it. But the people who believe it are the Javanese. The inhabitants will not approach it. The opposite is the exact truth. So, finally, what's the moral of this story? Two morals, I think. On the one hand, everything I've said is completely banal and well known. We know about the immortality of the constructed story. We know about its diffusion. We know how that works. We may not, however, have adequately thought about the genealogy and resonance of that fact in the epistemic culture of the High Enlightenment, which is so often treated as the moment of triage between fact and fiction. I think that's one theme to think about. So, for example, upas is an immortal trope. I show you here two cartoons, one of the 19th, one of the 20th century, upas tree as alcohol on the left, upas tree as Wall Street. I love this cartoon. On the right, this is 1908, New York Financial Journal. And the image with which I began, Thomas Danby's masterpiece of 1820, the upas tree. This painting was 65 feet long and 30 feet high. And it was the succès d'estime of the Royal Academy show of the summer of 1820, beating Joseph Mallord William Turner's painting of the Fighting Temeraire into second place. And this is the best image I've ever seen of the attempt to collect poison. That's what your man on the right's doing from the upas tree, which, as you see, has exterminated life everywhere around it. So think about the immortality of the story. But at the same time, I've also wanted to bring out, I hope, in an appealing way, the intimate entanglement in the fact-fiction distinction between questions of social judgment, questions of plausibility, questions of evidence and the weight of evidence, and above all, the attribution to large numbers of others of a failure to see what to us needs no effort to see at all. Thank you.
Vielen Dank, Professor Schäfer, für den Vortrag. Wir haben jetzt die Gelegenheit, Fragen zu stellen, und wie immer haben zuerst eigentlich die Studenten Gelegenheit, zu fragen.
Unless the lecture was a kind of U-Pass tree.
I would like to ask, first, of course, thank you for the treasure of death of you, which are the descriptions. But was there any approach to make maybe humans out of the or maybe something, anything they want to see? I did not really how many editions went out to make the Lucas tree something for a businessman for war.
So the difficulty in formulating that question is my argument. The U-Pass tree absolutely exists, and it absolutely does not. So the question, was there an attempt to make the U-Pass tree useful,
is an unstable interrogation. As far as we now know, from ethnobotany, from ethnohistory, and from the study by persons far more expert than I, in traditional forms of medical knowledge and warfare and hunting in the Indonesian archipelago, there is an extremely large number of different vegetable poisons, which are known and managed with exquisite delicacy by vast numbers of different peoples, Malays, Javanese, and so on, right through the archipelago. That is what the Europeans encounter, as far as we now know. So they're encountering a very sophisticated, extremely powerful, sociologically and anthropologically heterogeneous poison culture. My source, Daniel Carey, calls this an example of an early modern toxic encounter. There are other parts of the world in which Europeans have very similar experiences, in Latin America, in the Caribbean, in parts of the South Pacific, right? So the thing to begin with is an encounter with a socio-technically heterogeneous and sophisticated complex. That is what the Europeans in fact meet, right? What this then becomes in the botanies inaugurated by Rumphius and other great Dutch naturalists of the 17th century and continued right through the 1700s and well into the 1800s and the 1820s is what we could call a deflationary approach, since we're in a philosophy institute, in which there is a single entity called poison. There is one kind of tree, and it is deeply lethal in all its parts to everybody, right? That is the European model of East Indian plant poison. Now, when from 1788, from Thunberg's doctoral dissertation, through to Thomas Horsfield's magnificent essay on Antiaris toxicaria of 1817, 1818, in that period, there are about 20 to 25 projects to study the poison culture of the East Indies. And what's done is the identification of a single species, Antiaris toxicaria, along with a whole range of other species, with all the problems of identification that historians of natural history have made us used to, right? So the question, do they ever try to use the U-Pass tree to fight with, is a brilliant question, characteristically brilliant Schindlerian question. I hope that's recording. Because it reveals exactly the basis of the kind of transition I've been trying to describe for us, right? That's my argument. There's much more to say about that, but I'm resisting.
You pointed out that the I call it dimension of the UPSK was like a depiction of the exterminism they did themselves, the British. Now the question is, was there an intention behind this? Because what, as you pointed out, what came out of it is that the Malaysian or the people living there feared the trees in the end. I mean, at that time, no?
Okay.
Did I get it wrong?
That's what the Europeans say.
Okay, that's just the European view of what...
I haven't quoted any Malay sources here.
Okay. Because...
But I'm interrupting.
Because that was the question, who would have been stopped to go there, because there was no tourism or anything at that time that people traveled to Malaysia, normal people. And so I just wondered, what was the story, who should have hindered to go there, because the people who lived there, they killed them anyway, if they... felt they had to.
So to answer, that's a very good question. To answer that, we need a little more micro history. As a matter of fact, most of the poisons, for example, in Ambon and Banda and in Sulawesi and Makassar that are used for the darts, right, grow in trees that grow along the coast. Right, that's the first thing. But the skill in extracting and making and refining the poison for hunting and war belongs to the Highlanders who live inland. I mean, that's what we now know. When the Dutch arrive, what the Dutch do is to say the trees grow inland, right? So they completely mistake where the poison comes from. It actually comes from the land under their control, but they project it as though its source is beyond their control, and, as Rumphius says, a wise nature has hidden the sources of this poison from almost all men, right? So what we have to get our heads around, as philosophers, it seems to me, is how important the particular local circumstances of knowledge exchange are in particular concrete cases. In this case, the various modes of economic, social, military exchange and extermination are massively to do with concealing the source of an element of war, projecting the economic catastrophe that's being visited on the islands away from the colonizer towards nature. It is not us who are doing this. These are natural processes. These are very familiar moves, it seems to me, both then and in contemporary ecological and scientific politics. The naturalization of human-caused catastrophe is a very familiar move. If we want to think, okay, how does that happen? How is massively social contingent apocalypse naturalized? Then that's a very long conversation to have, and we should have it. And I think it's a matter where a lot of philosophical work needs to be done. It needs to be done about famine under the empire. It needs to be done about this kind of ecological project. It needs to be done about climatology. It needs to be done about agronomy and all sorts of other projects, right? And it's a major philosophical question of naturalization. Don't get me wrong, I'm not attributing a kind of collective psychopathology to a small group of British and Dutch butchers, much though it's tempting to do so, right? That's not the story here. The story is to think about who tells whom what and what are the particular circumstances under which they do so. That's one way of answering your excellent question. The other way of answering it is to begin to reflect philosophically on the project of Orientalism, because this is a story that belongs to the history of Orientalism. This is a story in which a social fact about encounter is projected onto the East, which is the land of marvels and wonders, and then attributed to the East as though it's there, as though for the Occidental, the Oriental is peculiarly subject to illusions like this one. Right? It's no coincidence that the other great trope of Orientalism, which is we have free will, they are automata, is massively being used in the case of the Turk. Right? Those two features of Orientalist fatalism and Orientalist superstition are both in play in the stories that I've told about the failed or successful attempt to discriminate between fact and fiction in this period. But again, Orientalism is a huge term, very troubling, and we maybe don't want to go there.
You just said that you didn't want to tell a story about British and
Germans first.
Sorry.
Go on.
Anyway, you just said that you didn't want to tell a story about British and Dutch butchers.
I didn't want to tell a story in which they psychopathologic.
Exactly. That was a much more general story than that. But would you go as far as, I mean, some might suggest that it's an even more general, extremely general story, maybe to some extent familiar story about the dialectics of enlightenment, as a kind of story that actually was very important for the sociology of scientific knowledge, namely to say, well, why would anyone believe anything that's false? Well, there's obviously, can't be someone like us, can't be someone who's rational and intelligent, has to be some kind of other, which then has, in some sense, that double kind of deceit, that first of all, you tell the wrong story about yourself, and secondly, that you seem to think that if you believe something true, that's kind of evident, that you don't need any special explanation to understand why someone believes something true. It's only when someone believes something false that you kind of bring in all those Orientalist tropes and so forth and so on. So in some ways, it seems that your story exemplifies this very general pattern, that maybe that's too abstract for the particular project that you're trying to tell, even though you just also said that you want to extend it to agronomy and all these other pursuits, which are more about truth production, perhaps, than about exposing evident falsehood and so forth. So anyway, just putting that out.
That's very helpful. I would like this story to be as general as possible and as wide and universally abstract as I could possibly make it. I hope this story explains absolutely everything that happened in the empire between 1600 and 1950. I'm not optimistic, I have to say, but that's my aim. More seriously, it's very interesting to ask what we might call the second level question here, which is how symmetrical can these kinds of accounts be? Right, you absolutely correctly point to the root of the sociology of knowledge that I profess in precisely the tradition which argues the kind of story that I've been telling here. But the other element of that story, of that methodological project, is its ruthless commitment to explanatory symmetry. Right, that's the other thing that's derived from these reflections. How symmetrical can one make this kind of story? A very promising line to pursue, it seems to me, is to reflect on the category species in my story, in this story. Because one could certainly imagine, and I have lots, and there's lots of evidence that this is true, that there is, as it were, a naturalist's regress, like the experimenter's regress that Harry Collins talks about in the case of replication, which is just a special version of the hermeneutic circle, right? There's a hermeneutic circle here. This goes back to Daniel's question. If a leaf arrives in London with a label saying UPAS, how do you know it is? You test it. Typically, if you're for example, Robert Boyle, on a dog. Dog being here the kind of standard poison calibrator of the early Royal Society, right? And Boyle and his crew, as Daniel Carey has pointed out to us, do indeed try to poison dogs in London at the Royal Society with Macassar poison. And overwhelmingly, the dogs do not die. Surprise. This is what we could call the poisoner's regress, in which they don't know if the dog is okay because this is not UPAS, or if the dog is okay because UPAS is not poisonous. They don't know which of those two alternatives is real. And this goes back to the question about native informants. This actually happens at the Royal Society in 1663 and 1664, no coincidence, during the war between England and Holland, in which various informants arrive in London from the East Indies saying, I'm sorry, guys, the poison you're using is not the right poison. You've been conned by Dutch traders who are selling you rubbish, which doesn't have any poisonous effect, right? So one can begin to see the rudiments of an absolutely symmetrical story beginning to be told, in which it's not just the Europeans invent a story about a poison tree because they're naturalizing the way in which they're exterminating the East Indians. And then when they denounce the story, they decide that it's only the East Indians who believe this story, even though the East Indians don't in fact believe this story at all, and they think that this is a story that the Europeans tell each other. And on top of that, the Europeans cannot even manage to work out until the 1810s, thanks to Latour, that's the naturalist, not the sociologist, how to calibrate poison judgment. The man who worked with Latour to standardize toxic estimates for UPAS is François Magendie, right? The single most famous, most important experimental physiologist in Napoleonic Paris. Right? So there's a convergence of a whole series of stories there about calibrating toxic testing, which would make the story more symmetrical than the one I had time to tell you. Right? And I think that's a way to go, right? That's the next task, I think, to make this story work.
Yeah, I think I'm going out of the frame of your talk a bit, and I'm thanking, no, but only because you were addressing this, this figure, this Orientalism figure. This, and I was now thinking about the next step, because now you are telling a symmetric story where the people from Java or whatever, they are outside of this history which is projected on them. Yeah, they are just elements of a story which is completely exterior to them. But then there is another move, and then it gets really complicated. But then if these people are taking up these kind of histories produced on them, and they take it up to identify themselves, what does it mean for the work of the historian to analyze this? And what does it mean for history? This question is
That is the most important question. We're in danger of reinventing the wheel a bit. That kind of work is done very well by ethno-historians and by indigenous activists, especially in Indonesia and in the subcontinent, in really powerful ways, right? There's a huge literature, I was delighted to see, on the way in which representations of toxic encounters are powerful moves in Malay-Dutch, Malay-Malay, Malay, other groups in counties. There's a vast literature about this. Just to give you one small flavor of that, right? from at least the late 1700s onwards, and this goes back again to Daniel's question, the way in which a lot of European incomers are described is as poison. So a lot of Malay colonial, anti-colonial resistance from the late 1700s onwards, especially after the disappearance of the Dutch East India Company in 1799, is to represent Dutch and British colonial regimes as toxic. So there's this very elaborated political vocabulary of the toxic quality of the colonial regime. Now that is and that is not the absorption of the UPAS story. And it's then being played back yet again into the encounter, right? They are the people who kill everything for miles around, right? That's their nature, if you pardon the expression. Okay, so there's that story. And then alongside that, we must also, as historians, not lose sight of the role that the commodity exchange system plays throughout this period. By about 1800, 1810, this, of course, is still very, very much a spice economy. But by the end of the 1800s, it's also a rubber economy, right? And that becomes incredibly important for the later history of UPAS. Since UPAS, in most of its versions, is a liquid which you tap from a tree that bears a striking resemblance, technically, not botanically, to the way in which rubber is extracted from rubber plants, right? So there's a literature on UPAS and on Antiaris toxicaria, which is tangled up with the rubber industry of Malaya and Borneo right through till the 1990s, right? The most recent discussion I've seen in the botanical scientific literature about Antiaris, UPAS, and so on is in the context of the International Rubber Journal, which I recommend to all of you, keep it by your bedside if you find it's hard to get to sleep. And it's a long discussion, goes back to what we were talking about earlier, about how many varieties of rubber and how many varieties of poison tree are there in this particular part of Malaya, because they have to rely on native collectors to go and get the rubber and bring it into central collection points. And these are guys who also go and collect poison. So they need to know what they're doing, right? And the usual, what I've called the poisonous regress, applies. They don't really know what species we're dealing with. I have a line from a pharmacognosist in London in the 1970s. Pharmacognosists are scientists who are expert on the extraction of medical products from natural products. Good job. This pharmacognosist says, it's obvious that Malay and indigenous hunters have a far more minute set of distinctions between different kinds of UPAS than is botanically justified. And we need to explain the source of their confusion. This is 1978, not 1668. So the whole work of economic resistance, contestation, and so on continues. It's massively studied. It's of huge scientific and economic significance, right? It doesn't fade away with the end of a certain kind of mythos that I describe using this image. I hope that's a kind of answer to what you wanted to get at, but it's a really good question.
Now, I would like to move back the focus a little bit to Europe with my question. And we pose it about roughly as follows. Taking everything you told us for granted and accepting that fact-producing turned in the late 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, into producing a populace as a figure that is endowed with superstition and all these false beliefs, whereas the scientists or the learned people, they know about facts.
I wonder whether there is not a little complementary story to be told about the history of superstition, which might be factored into the story and then raises another interesting issue, I think, related to the story you're telling. Going back to the 18th century, about 1750s, 1760s, reading authors like Jean d'Alembert, we see that superstition and false beliefs are again ascribed to a certain social group, which is quite different from the social group that you're identifying in your story, and that's the social group of priests, perhaps even aristocrats. So it's the social group that d'Alembert would describe as les grands, and those who play a huge role in society. So it seems a bit that your story is sort of convoluted with another story in which the ascription of superstition and false beliefs moves from one social group to another social group, from the high-ups in the Ancien Régime and the priests and the Jesuits to this populace that is identified elsewhere.
That is Jacques Revelle's argument.
Well,
and that is exactly what he says. He says, and I quoted him, that what happens in the period from the 1790s, in fact, he dates it to Pierre Bayle's Marseillaise de la Comète, so 1698, all the way through to the end of the 18th century, is exactly what you're describing.
So, but if this is the case, so if Revelle is right about that, so that superstition is transferred from a high-up social group to a low-level social group, the question would be, and this is almost a Marxist-type question, whether this change is brought about by a change of the social status of the knowers, of the learned people, whereas they are gens de lettres in the 1750s, not in a crucial social position yet. Then comes the revolutionary period, the formation of the bourgeois state, the national state. Now this is the dominant class, and so they can identify superstition in the lower classes.
So, yes.
Yes.
Two very quick things. That is exactly the anal argument. That is what Revelle says in Les Fonctions des Intellectuels, La Culture Populaire. And he's relying on a group of essays in Anal about the association between priestcraft and superstition during the early, by my standards, in New Brighton. And as I say, I'm completely persuaded by the validity of this. The dodgy bit is what had been denounced in the name of reason, point de suspension, was now invalidated by being labelled the product of an inferior social group, right? This is to distinguish what, for me, absolutely goes together. It's denounced in the name of accepted reason as the product of an inferior social group. Revelle distinguishes what I think absolutely go together. It's an extremely, I'm teaching Sussex, it's an extremely familiar move in d'Alembert and Voltaire to insist that priests are peasants, that scholars are superstitious, know nothing, poverty-stricken, and ignorant. In other words, to collapse that hierarchy, or at least to try to do so, that you can't put a cigarette paper between the ignorant superstition of the Catholic hierarchy and the ignorant superstition of their flock. The whole group is put into this inferior world. That is the kind of complex subversion that seems to me, from the other side of the channel, to be going on, right? And it's exactly what does not happen in London at all, which is why I've chosen this magnificent English cartoon about who it is who believes that vaccination is dangerous, right? This is a cartoon by Jenner, applying the first vaccination against smallpox. And you need to ask yourself the question, who is it who thinks that when you're injected with cowpox, cows grow on your arm? What is Gilray showing us there? The seems to me a fantastic image from that point of view. It's not entirely unambiguous about who is being denounced here. Is this an anti-vaccination cartoon? Is this a pro-vaccination cartoon? Is this an anti-peasant cartoon? Is this a cartoon against Edward Jenner or in favour of him? It's a very unstable moment in this process. So that's why I did that. But it's a brilliant point. And what we need, in a certain sense, is the prequel of what I've just talked about. Because I don't think that set of suggestions has been adequately pursued in the literature on the scientific revolution and the Baroque, right? I don't think we have that either. Yet. So, thank you very much.
Last question.
I have a very brief question about the presentation of the Turkish chess play at the Leipzig Fair.
Yes.
As I understood it, it was first perceived as a scientific breakthrough or was analyzed as such.
And, I think that's right.
Yeah, and what I asked myself, why was it? Because the presentation, as I understood, was more like a Jahrmarktaktion. There was it was left to figure out.
I mean, it's Leipzig Fair, not the Brandenburg Academy of Sciences, right?
Yes. And could you elaborate? Why is that? Why did they first analyze it as a more or less scientific breakthrough of all the Magnus work and now implying that there was a human in there controlling?
Well, I completely misled you, right? I left out the first 10 years of the Turk's life. It doesn't start at the Leipzig Fair, it starts in Vienna at court. It was designed by Wolfgang von Kempelen, if you're German, or Kempelen Farkas, if you're Hungarian, because he's a Slovak. And a great engineer, a great hydraulic engineer, who is also very well known indeed for inventing and designing one of the first speaking machines. At exactly the same time and just after, he designs a kind of bellows which imitates the sound of the human voice. And the Budapest Institute of Phonetics and Human Language is named after him. And he designed the chess play. So it's a piece of court natural philosophy, initially. And for many years after, right, its entry into the world of the Jahrmarkt is very interesting, right, because it both summons into existence a kind of audience that is then going itself to be analysed as dupes, right? And it also connects questions of inanimate reason in a fundamental way, right? I've massively telescoped the story, mainly to bring out the similitude that I see between the long life of the Turk, which goes on way beyond its denunciation. Right? It goes to North America, it makes a lot of money, it goes to Cuba, comes back from Cuba, ends up in Philadelphia, and is destroyed in a fire. That's actually quite a sad story. And modern replicas exist. In fact, I've taken part in a congress at which the Turk played the only international grandmaster in Ireland, and won. And I'm promising you, when you see it, if the replica is good, and you absolutely know how it works, one can still put oneself into that magnificent Sartrean state of histrionic suspense in which this machine is playing chess, right? I mean, its progeny is the Turing test, fine, right? The Turing test is, after all, a philosophical quandary in which a machine is pretending to be a human who is pretending to be a machine, right? And in the Turkish case, it's a human pretending to be a machine, pretending to be a human. That intercalation of human and machine is, I think, precisely what we need to analyse there from the philosophical point of view. Well, that's, again, another story. Thank you very much.